Hey folks, welcome back to the Demystify Sci podcast. Today on the show, we are talking about something very prosaic and at the same time magnificent, incredible, and full of mystery, which is the food that we eat. In particular, the role of agrochemicals in our long-term health outcomes. And it's a little depressing because it seems like there's something awry in the food chain for us human beings in the West in particular. And we are picking that apart mechanistically. We're talking everything from deuterium levels in as a result of these herbicides, inflammation, dysregulation of metabolism, and all the downstream effects of every disease. I can't think of any disease that's not covered by this, essentially. And it ties into a recent conversation we had with Thomas Seyfried that unfortunately we botched the recording of. So if you're listening right now, Thomas, I'm really sorry. He's agreed to come back sometime this year, and we'll try to get that out to you. But that concerns the role of sugar in cancer and the possible hope with ketogenic diets and so forth of rescuing us from this terrible disease that we only seem to be able to try and kill right now, but not really heal. So, huge discussion, a lot of really nuanced ideas underneath it, especially concerning why people don't have access to this information, which gets into a really ugly side of the way that things are funded and the way that information is surfaced in the world that we're living in. And we're trying really hard to avoid that channel strike from YouTube right now. So if you notice some bleep outs in this episode, I'm sure that you can do the math and figure out what we're talking about, but we have to avoid a few trigger words. So we might cut some of the key terms out.
Some of the key syllables have been removed.
This is the age we live in, folks. Honestly, it's very disturbing that it's come to this, that we can't have just an open marketplace of ideas. But as long as we want to be on the biggest website in the world, which is YouTube, we're going to have to play by the rules. So we'll try to squirm around it to the best of our ability for now.
And our guest for this conversation is Stephanie Seneff, who is a computer science professor at MIT, who has been at MIT for her entire career, undergraduate, graduate, PhD, postdoc. Now she's faculty, and she's been there for a really long time, and is studying the effects of glyphosate, specifically on autism. So she believes that she has found a link between the presence of glyphosate in the food system and the autism epidemic. And that is a really controversial claim, because if you go into the literature and you look, the literature basically is filled with papers on opposite sides. One side is saying, here, this is evidence of glyphosate causing problems. Here, there's literature that's saying, no, glyphosate causes absolutely no problems. You might as well just be drinking glasses of it for breakfast every morning. And through the conversation with Stephanie, we unpack, first and foremost, her biochemical mechanism for how this is happening. We deal with the fact that in the literature, there is still scant evidence for this biochemical mechanism, why there's scant evidence for this mechanism, and all of the downstream effects beyond autism, right? Because the mechanism that she's proposing is modification of proteins by glyphosate in the metabolic chain, which causes inflammation, and the inflammation then feeds back onto the rest of the body, causing problems in the gut, causing problems with the immune system. She points to the fact that autism is considered an autoimmune disorder, in addition to being whatever nebulous collection of symptoms it is. And so it's just so cool to have this conversation with her, because she's thought so deeply about it. She's incredibly passionate. She's incredibly well-informed. She comes at it with the engineer's mindset, but is doing biology and epidemiology and is just on fire. And so it's a really fantastic conversation. We think you're really going to enjoy it. We're going to have her back and keep going about deuterated water, about the role of water in biological systems, cancer, what else?
Structured water,
yeah. So
it's going to be a big future discussion. So this is just the first. I think this is we found somebody who we really can relate to, who's really deep thinker and is uncovering all of the stones, and no details left, nebulous or there's no room for the imagination here. In some sense, there's a lot of mechanistic interplay going on. By the way, if you guys are enjoying this kind of discussions, I really want to point out to you that we are at a critical point in our civilization where we're able to actually do this kind of thing without having a boss over our shoulder telling us that we're interfering with somebody's conflicts of interest. We don't have any sponsors. We're not selling anything. And the only reason that we can do that is because we're entirely supported by listeners like you. And so what you can do is literally shave off the tiniest chunk from whatever money you're bringing in. Like, give us just a couple dollars over at patreon.com. And all those tiny little donations add up to the point that we can continue doing this program with all of our time and effort and actually expose all these incredible ideas that aren't going to just happen in the corporate-centered, product-driven media space. That's just not going to work out. So, like, support that revolution. Get behind it. It's the way that we move forward and actually create a healthy information landscape so you can make decisions. And so we as a civilization can make decisions about where we're going with this whole spaceship Earth thing.
And if you have already donated and you want to get more involved, consider coming to our very first conference. It is now just a little bit more than a month away, which is really exciting. We're gathering everybody in Austin, Texas for April 7th and 8th. To watch the eclipse. We're going to have 2 days of talks, workshops. We're going to hang out, get dinner, just dive into all of the subjects that we deal with on the podcast, but for a change, in person. I don't think that it's our last conference. I think that it's just our first one. It's been kind of crazy to plan it, but also really fun. We'll hopefully do it someplace that is cheaper and more accessible next time, but
it's going to be special, though. Austin's an interesting town, and of course, the eclipse only happens, well, I think the next one's not until, what, 2044.
So, like, you got another 20 years before you catch another American eclipse. So come out, hang out, and if you can't, that's totally fine. Find us on Twitter, Facebook, Discord, TikTok, Instagram, email. We have a website.
We're out there. You can get a hold of us.
And in the meantime, enjoy our conversation with Stephanie Seneff. We really hope that you do, and we hope that you come back again. We'll see you next time.
The scientific revolution starts now.
Let us see in the dark.
I hate to have to do this, but I think that we have to be careful. I want this conversation to go out on YouTube.
I know, that's true.
And it's like the top of the list is that you cannot talk about the link between
Yikes. All right, well, maybe we can bleep out the words that we've used so far. It'll be a little tedious, but I think we might be able to catch on.
Yeah, I think that we can say what we have so far. I'm of the opinion that the direct link between the two I haven't found a paper that I look at and I'm like, this is a massive, super obvious analysis of the link between like X substance and Y disease. But whenever there's a setup where you can't talk about that correlation, that freaks me out really, really badly because I know that we don't live at a time of true freedom of information or freedom of inquiry. And we have this image of science as being this objective...
Like a competition of ideas.
Yeah, this objective, beautiful competition of ideas where you have people that are just publishing things to the best of their abilities and may the best man win or whatever. And that's just, it's such a misrepresentation of how science actually works because, like you're saying, we have a massive lobbying industry that is... do you know how big the market share of glyphosate is? Like, what's their yearly profit off of
that? I should know that, but I don't.
I mean, it's got to be. If not billions, then like...
Well, Bayer is really hurting. Their stock has been tanking ever since they bought Monsanto. because of glyphosate, because it has so many... Bayer is now the parent company of Monsanto, and they're in Germany, and they bought Monsanto, and their stock immediately started tanking, and it's been tanking ever since, and they've had a lot of trouble with lawsuits in America on non-Hodgkin's lymphoma being linked to glyphosate. They've had a huge problem with that that's ongoing.
And how have those lawsuits been resolving? Because I remember looking at this, and this was actually like in one of the articles that I was reading, it was pointing to the fact that lawsuits were being won against Monsanto for causing non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. But the people that were analyzing the studies were like, you can't use that as evidence because what this really is activist judges trying to punish Monsanto without paying attention to the weight of scientific evidence.
That's interesting that that's how you see it, because the evidence is growing stronger and stronger, by the way, and so many papers are coming out. I can't even keep up with them anymore. I just saw another one this morning, a nice paper on glyphosate. They exposed chick eggs to glyphosate, and then the embryo developed, and then they looked at the difference between the control groups. They had a control group, they had a glyphosate exposure, and they had a Roundup exposure with the same amount of glyphosate, but the additional chemicals in the Roundup. And both the glyphosate exposed and the Roundup exposed chicks had a serious problem with the epithelium of their gut, causing basically leaky gut, you know, messing up the tight junctions between the epithelial cells and the gut. And leaky gut syndrome is something that it's been kind of a buzzword in the social media, because a lot of people are suffering from gut problems that are linked to leaky gut, an impaired epithelial barrier. And that links to celiac disease as well, which I think glyphosate's the primary cause of the epidemic in celiac disease.
Yeah, maybe we could just lay out the basic mechanistic basis. I know you've talked about this a lot on other podcasts, but we should at least get people oriented towards what is going on with respect to this molecule and your health in the long term.
Yeah, no, that's a big topic.
And
I wrote my whole book on it. And
of course,
my book is very scientific. I don't know if you've seen, have you looked at my book at all?
We haven't read the book, but we listened to some podcasts that go over the book. So we're aware of the different sections.
Yeah, so the book, the center stage of the book is my theory for how glyphosate works and why it is so toxic and why it is so unique in its toxicity. And so this is something that I'm very proud of, actually, and I believe I'm right. And of course, the industry denies that it's possible. What I'm saying is happening. They say it's not possible. So, you know, you don't know who to believe. But from my evidence, and I keep on finding new evidence, it's very clear to me that if glyphosate has this property that I talk about in my book, it can explain why one chemical could cause so many diseases, because I argue that it causes diabetes. It's a causal factor in diabetes, obesity, inflammatory gut, you know, celiac disease, liver problems and kidney problems and breast cancer and you know, pancreatic cancer, autism, Alzheimer's, Parkinson's disease. There's a huge list of diseases that I think glyphosate is contributing to. And I think glyphosate is, in my opinion, the number one problem as far as toxic chemical exposures in this country, in the United States, number one problem. I believe that.
Do you think that the mechanism by which it causes disease is uniform across all of these different conditions? Because at some point, I always tell this story, even though it reflects poorly on me. Many years ago, Shiloh was like, you know, I think that all diseases are inflammatory at heart.
Yes.
And I was like, how could you say such? I was just like, I was very mean about it. And I'm sorry. Because now, years later, it seems everybody that we talk to seems to be pointing at that being the case.
Yes, I mean, I agree.
If I can summarize your mechanism a little bit, it seems like just tracing from the back end that these cells are getting erroneous forms of building blocks that they need at the end of the day, because the gut and the immune cells are processing these, the gut bacteria are supposed to process some of these precursors in one way, but they don't, because you've got this imbalance of the different types of bacteria that you need to produce those various precursors. Is that a fair summary of the back end of that mechanism with respect to how it hurts your cells at the end of the day?
Yeah, I think that a major part is the gut microbiome, and they get exposed to the glyphosate, and certain ones are very sensitive to it. They get killed off. And that allows pathogens to overgrow. And then the immune cells come in to fight the pathogens, and you get the inflammatory gut, you get the leaky gut. And then you have all kinds of problems. You can't absorb nutrients, you know, you've got, and there's mineral imbalances, because glyphosate is a mineral chelator. And of course, the glyphosate famously disrupts critical enzymes in the bacteria that produce critical nutrients for the host. And that's the shikimate pathway. There's a particular enzyme in the shikimate pathway called EPSP synthase that many of the gut microbes have that enzyme, and they use that enzyme to produce essential amino acids for the host. And that's tryptophan, tyrosine, and phenylalanine. And those amino acids are building blocks of the proteins, but they're also precursors to all the neurotransmitters and melanin, the skin tanning agent, melatonin, serotonin, thyroid hormone, So many important molecules come out of that shikimate pathway, and they all become deficient when your gut microbes are being disturbed by glyphosate. So that's a big part of the problem.
And how much of that leaky gut syndrome, that overall gut inflammation, how much of that is that the immune system is sort of preoccupied with this crisis in that local region of the body that it neglects other problems it might have? And how much of it is directly toxins coming from those bacteria that are slipping through the walls and things like that?
Yeah, it's hard to say exactly how much this, how much that, but there's many, many things that go wrong. And part of it is just the metabolism doesn't happen properly. So one thing is that glyphosate, it raises the pH of the gut. This has been shown experimentally. And when the pH is too high, the acid-loving bacteria can't thrive, so they become deficient. And the acid-loving bacteria are the ones that make the short-chain fatty acids, and like butyrate. And butyrate is absolutely essential as a nutrient for the colonocytes, which are the cells that line the colon. So the colon becomes sick, you know, and you get things like constipation. I mean, that's another one that's going up dramatically. Glyphosate, I think, is a major problem with constipation. And so it's a lot of things are going wrong, and a lot of nutrients are not being made. Even the vitamins, the bacteria make vitamins for the host. They make, as I mentioned, these aromatic amino acids. They make so many essential amino acids are supplied by the gut microbiome, and those enzymes are suppressed. Both methionine and the aromatic amino acids are suppressed by glyphosate. That's been shown in both plants and microbes. And methionine is a really important amino acid. It's the it's the critical sulfur-containing amino acid. And you can derive other sulfur-containing amino acids can be derived from methionine. So they're not quite essential. They're conditionally essential. But when you don't have methionine, they become essential as well. And then I think glyphosate messes up the enzymes, actually, that convert methionine.
Well, methionine is also the start codon for protein synthesis.
Exactly. You're right. Every protein needs a methionine to get it going. So you're going to have probably issues with protein synthesis if you don't have enough methionine. It's also the universal methyl donor.
We were thinking about this earlier
today. Methylation pathway. Yeah.
We were thinking about this earlier today where it's like we have some tools that are able to look at things that are about specific, you know, gene mutations or perhaps different protein modifications, but understanding the full arc of the push and pull of protein synthesis and the availability of these individual amino acids in context of a biological system is stuff that's still pretty hard to do without significant transgenic modifications. Like when I was working in a bacterial lab, I mean, you can look at the amount of protein that's being generated inside of a cell, but looking at the amount of an unmodified protein that's being generated is much more difficult than making some artificial construct that you're then studying.
When you say unmodified, you mean accurately rendered from the code?
Well, so most of the protein work that I did was antibody-based. And so you're doing like Western blots, or you're doing pull-downs, or you're doing these like, the basis is that you have an antibody that will bind your protein of interest, and then you can do some kind of imaging technique that allows you to detect that interaction. Mm-hmm. But it's like an order of magnitude cheaper to produce a protein that has a generic modification that you transgenically add to the end of it into your model organism, so that model organism produces the modified protein. And when you do the experiment, you're looking for the modified protein because the antibody that grabs it is way cheaper.
Interesting. That's very interesting. It gets complicated, doesn't it?
Right. And so it's very hard to look at these like quiet dynamics of protein synthesis and behavior, because the tools for doing it are expensive, and we can't look into the cell and just be like, oh, look, those little proteins are moving around. It's a very a coarse-grained analysis that we do of the dynamics of proteins inside of cells. And so if you're saying that there's this like very, very pervasive but unconventional modification of the dynamics of synthesis and the amount of synthesis, and maybe like, we don't really know how amino acid choice works in a moment inside the cell, where it's like when it comes across the methionine, what happens if the methionine is low? Is it possible for it to stick the wrong amino acid into that position? Like,
yeah, well, homocysteine actually competes with methionine, and you can get homocysteine into the protein by mistake. And then there's some mechanisms in place to take it out and fix it. So the biology is aware this can happen and has a repair mechanism in place. The same thing with DNA. You know, DNA can get mutated, and then there's a repair mechanism. These repair mechanisms are very complex that try to fix these errors that are made. But copying from the RNA to the protein is actually a sloppy process. It's much more willing. The biology is much more willing to make mistakes, because many times that protein can have some errors here and there, but it's not. It still works, you know, and it has a way to evaluate whether it's good or not. And if it isn't good, it just rips it all apart and builds it again, you know. So the whole biological system is geared towards kind of being sloppy with making the proteins and then getting rid of the ones that didn't turn out good. And this is where glyphosate plays a major, major role, in my opinion. And this is my theory, which is that, so glyphosate is a glycine molecule. That's the smallest amino acid, no side chains. That glyphosate is glycine, except that it has extra stuff stuck onto its nitrogen atom. So it has this methylphosphonate unit that's stuck onto the nitrogen. That makes all the difference in the world, because it behaves very, very differently from glycine. But it looks like glycine as far as the machinery is concerned that makes the proteins. So what happens is glyphosate substitutes for glycine when the protein is being made. And I think this is happening in many different proteins all over the body. And some of those proteins have certain glycine residues that are absolutely essential, like at the active site. And if that's not glycine, the protein's dead in the water. It can't do its job. And so I've actually been able to, I have an ability to search a certain special tools on the web that can allow me to find specific proteins that are going to be very vulnerable to glyphosate attack. And then I can see if those proteins, if mutations in those proteins are linked to the diseases that I know are correlated with glyphosate. So I have this giant puzzle to solve. And it's been really fun. I love puzzles. And this puzzle is really quite a challenge.
I mean, protein mutations too, that's a pretty new technology to be able to look for these things. Proteomics was just coming online maybe 10 years ago or something.
And let me say, I don't think that proteomics is looking specifically at protein mutations. Like, protein sequencing is not a thing the way that DNA sequencing is. Because DNA sequencing, you can pull the DNA out of the cell, break it apart letter by letter, and look at it. You can kind of do that with proteins.
My comprehension of this is, if my comprehension is bad, I'm sure people listening are like, what the hell are you talking about?
I just remember, because like I did a lot of like protein biochemistry when I was doing, I worked on tuberculosis, and we were like crystallizing a protein and trying to identify it. And I remember I was always like, why don't we just sequence it? Like, we need to find out like what it looks like.
Yeah.
And my boss was like, that's not done. Like, you cannot do protein.
These like two, they're like these three-dimensional Western blot type things. I don't know. Maybe you can explain a little bit how you look for
protein folding is so difficult. That's such a difficult task, protein folding. We have major computers running for hours trying to figure out how these proteins fold. It's a really difficult task to figure out how it folds. And the way it folds is critical for how it works. And sometimes they'll misfold. You know, you get amyloidogenic elements that cause Alzheimer's disease because the protein has misfolded. And you also
How do you evidence these things other than looking for amyloids? Can you see mutation? How do you see the mutations in proteins?
Well, for me, it's easy because I just run these. You can look things up because they have a library of all the different. They have figured out the protein, the amino acid sequence of a large number of proteins in all animals and plants and whatnot. They've got this big database, which is great. You can go and find the exact amino acid sequence for any protein, pretty much any protein you can think of. And that's what I actually do. So I can give you an example. It's actually a good example of a particular protein that I figured out only recently. And I'm very glad to know that because it's critical for autism. I'm still figuring out the details of how glyphosate causes autism. And I've got a really good story that I'm building. I'm working on an article that's already too long. I have to figure out how to get it published, because most journals will say you've got to shorten it as the first thing. But it's but I'm really fascinated. I feel like I'm making great progress in actually understanding at a molecular level how glyphosate is causing autism. And so this particular protein, let's see,
Hey folks, really quick interruption. I just want to remind you that the only reason we're able to do these really in-depth conversations without a boss breathing down our neck or some sponsor telling us that they don't like our message or anything like that is because we're entirely supported by patrons over at patreon.com. And people are getting together right now and shaving off the tiniest piece of their income. If it's just a few dollars, a couple of dollars a month that you can give us, it all goes towards us being able to put 100% of our attention into this project and not have to be concerned with how are we going to make money? How are we going to keep the lights on? You know, maybe we should find some sponsor or find somebody, some production company that can make this better. No, we're not going to do that. And the only way we're not going to do that is by your support at patreon.com. Seriously, this is an incredible age where we have the ability to access all sorts of perspectives, and they don't have to come from some monolithic media organization. And the only way that's possible is through this crowdfunding possibility that is the hallmark of a healthy ecosystem, a healthy information ecosystem. And so please come over to patreon.com, check it out, and consider supporting this project.
Cystathionine beta synthase. Cystathionine beta synthase, CBS, that's the name of the protein. And the way that I figured this one out is interesting because this is kind of the technique that I use. It's computer science technique in a way to figure out which proteins are going to be susceptible to glyphosate. So CBS is a protein that's involved in the methylation and sulfation pathways, and it actually is essential for producing cysteine from methionine. I mentioned before, methionine is deficient in the presence of glyphosate. Glyphosate messes up with the enzymes that produce methionine by the gut microbes. So methionine is deficient, and then if this enzyme is also deficient, cysteine is going to become essential as well. Cysteine is conditionally essential, but you need to be able to have that pathway that produces cysteine from methionine working. Cysteine, of course, is one of the three amino acids in glutathione, and glutathione is another very essential nutrient. It's an antioxidant, very important in the liver and the brain to mop up those reactive oxygen species and protect the cells. And glutathione depends on cysteine critically. So then glutathione becomes deficient, and glyphosate's been shown to cause glutathione deficiency. And glutathione and cysteine deficiency are linked to autism. So all of that fits beautifully. If CBS is disrupted by glyphosate, that could explain a lot about autism. So I basically did a search for keywords that are in the pathway involved in methylation and cysteine production, looking for images. And so then I get a figure from a paper that looks good. I grab that figure, I go back and I say, what paper was that in? And that's how I found this paper that talks about CBS deficiency, many different mutations. So it's one of those enzymes that has lots of mutations, like glucose 6-phosphate dehydrogenase. There are certain enzymes that in the humans have many, many mutations that cause disease.
And I glucose, think just to slow you down just for a second, glucose 6-phosphate dehydrogenase is an enzyme that's part of the electron transport, or not the electron transport chain, but it's part of glycolysis, where it's modifying sugar as it moves through the metabolism. And it's a necessary step in the conversion of sugar into metabolic byproducts. And so you're saying that if you damage metabolism in multiple different ways, each different type of damage branches you out into different types of diseases.
That's why it's really, really complicated, because each of these enzymes is getting affected by glyphosate. It's just subpar. It's not being completely destroyed because only some of the molecules are getting the glyphosate in them, but it's subpar. So all these different enzymes are not working to full capacity, and collectively they cause problems because at each step is something, you know, going wrong. And so so G6PD is the most mutated enzyme in human physiology, has the most number of genetic mutations that cause disease. And I think that's interesting. In fact, this other one, CBS, also has a lot of genetic mutations.
So if I remember correctly, it's basically, so like as you're going through glycolysis, there's the way that the enzymes work is that they take the sugar, they break it in half, and one of the sugars is immediately ready. It's glucose 6-phosphate, and it's ready to go into the TCA cycle,
That's not glucose 6-phosphate. It's a 3. Oh wait, three.
Oh, you're right. You're right.
It's the three one.
It's the three. So basically, you linearize the sugar.
Yeah, and this is actually really great if we want to get off on this topic, because I have some really good things to say about it. But go ahead.
Well, I think that it's just so interesting because you're basically pointing at this central metabolic enzyme that is not like gone, because if it's gone, you die. Like, if you can't make this conversion, you can't make ATP. And if you can't make ATP, you're just dead.
Right, exactly.
But it's at the heart of metabolism.
Yes.
Because it's a key enzyme for taking sugar and breaking it into a molecule that can actually go into the metabolic pathway.
You are right.
And so when you break it in all of these different ways, what you're probably doing is you're probably affecting the rate at which sugar moves into this pathway. And then this feeds back into what you were saying about glutathione, because glutathione is a master redox regulator, which is, you're saying that it's like sopping up all these byproducts, which is exactly right. Like it's this, it's like if there's a teeter-totter of like too reduced or too oxidized in the cell, then there's all these little molecules, like NADH is one of them people have probably heard of, like NADP is one of them, glutathione is one of them, and there's these small molecules that are basically just shuttles, and they move through different compartments in the cell and are intended to make sure that the byproducts don't build up in such a way that they get in the way of these reactions, because this is all so electrochemical. And so if you have an excess of charged species hanging around, or you have a deficiency of charged species hanging around, then you can't perform the reactions. And so having this enzyme that's at the center of metabolism that breaks in all of these different branch points really feeds back into what you're saying about glyphosate. If it's integrating into all of these proteins and screwing with their ability to function in like small ways, then you're just having pleiotropic effects all over the cell. And it's not one disorder. It's just all of these different things breaking in all of these different ways, depending on where that substitution is occurring.
Exactly. Yeah, that's very good. And we can go to that. Let's go to that, because glycolysis is very interesting. And that's another place where glyphosate has a major effect. And it has to do with that 3-phosphoglycerate. That's the name of that molecule that you were trying to think of, 3-phosphoglycerate.
That's right.
And it's so fascinating with glucose, because it has 6 carbons and it's a ring. And it gets cut into, it gets linearized, it gets chopped into 2 3-carbon sugars. And that's this 3-phosphoglycerate. And I've forgotten the name of the other one, but there's 2 of them. And they have exactly the same chemical formula, but they have a different arrangement of the atoms. And there's an isomerase that puts them back and forth between each other. And only one side goes out. That's the 3-phosphoglycerate. You were hinting to that when you were talking. The 3-phosphoglycerate can keep going and eventually feed into the mitochondria and produce the ATP and burn the sugar, you know, finish his job. The other one doesn't. And that's very, very interesting to me. The isomerase brings them back and forth, and it mostly pulls them to the wrong one.
Hmm.
So at equilibrium, you have like 95% of the molecules, the 3-carbon molecules, are the wrong one, and only 5% is the right one. But that enzyme yanks it away all the time. So then some more comes in. So it's slowly dribbling back in. And so there's a question of what is that isomerase exactly doing? Why is it? It's very important. Why is it so important? What is it doing? And this gets to the issue of deuterium, which I would love to get into, because I'm so fascinated by deuterium. And this is a very good place where you can sort of explain what's going on with the deuterium.
Yes, please, because this was actually really funny. We have a patron, his name's Rigaleb, and he recommended that we talk to you. And I was like, well, we actually are talking to her on Tuesday, which is fantastic. And he specifically was like, you have to ask her about deuterium. So I'm very glad that we've
So here we are. And you brought it right in, because it's a perfect example of the deuterium issue. So so that isomerase is actually clearing off deuterium. When it goes from the good guy, from the one that's going to keep going to the other one, when it goes this way, if there's a deuterium starting over here, it'll drop it off in the water. And when it comes over here, it has much less deuterium. And then furthermore, when it comes back, the enzyme that brings it back to this guy strongly favors hydrogen over deuterium. So the deuterium either gets dropped off in the water or stuck in the wrong guy. And then the right guy gets really good hydrogen that is not deuterium, loaded up to become NADH. So the next step, when it goes out the door, is a dehydrogenase. And that dehydrogenase removes that hydrogen that's almost certain not to be deuterium and sticks it onto NAD plus to make NADH. And NADH is God, because all the NADH molecules, every which way you make it, as far as I've looked, they're trying to get rid of deuterium. So they want that H to be a golden H, no deuterium. And then that H is delivered to the mitochondria. The mitochondria have an NADH dehydrogenase, very important, that takes the H off and gives it to the intermembrane space to drive the ATPase pumps. So the pumps, the ATPase pumps hate deuterium. It's like sugar in the gas tank.
And they, so, like, they foul the reaction, right? Because basically the way that it works is that inside of the mitochondria, you have all of these enzymes that are in the inner membrane. And that's what is called the electron transport chain. And so you have this TCA cycle that's running in the lumen of the mitochondria. So you get this three carbon sugar.
In the gas tank.
In the gas tank. And it's running, and it's exactly as you say. I think that it's succinate
dehydrogenase is another enzyme that's been shown in multiple studies to be suppressed by glyphosate.
And so basically there's this exchange between the three carbon compound that has the right hydrogen on it and these proteins that are in the mitochondrial membrane. And that exchange is what powers, like, that hydrogen that gets moved.
Yeah, I understand.
Is, like, key for the production of
but
ATP.
What is the deuterium? It just, it weighs too much?
Yeah, like,
deuterium is hydrogen, heavy hydrogen.
But, like, it fouls the reaction
clogs
somehow?
Up the
it binds better to things, yeah. So it's less likely to let go. And it's heavy and clunky, so it kind of jams up the gears in the ATPase pumps.
Why does it bind better? That's very strange to me. It doesn't have a different charge, right?
It's heavier, so it's got a greater mass.
The charge is the same. Right?
It's more likely to stick with the molecule that it's with rather than connecting to. You know, they have these ionic bonds between different things that hold molecules together that aren't covalently bonded. There's an ionic bond attachment between two molecules.
Sure.
That they're more likely to stick with the molecule they're on rather than to have a weaker bond with a molecule on the other guy. And that makes a very big difference in the structure of DNA, for example. DNA doesn't like a deuterium either because it's going to mess up the whole bonds that hold the two rings together. You have these two chains and they're held together by these hydrogen bonds.
So you're saying it, like, offsets the dipole in these bonds somehow?
Yeah, essentially, yes.
Interesting.
It weakens the ionic bonds and strengthens the covalent bonds and then messes up all the, because the biology is very intricately, you know, tuned to how things are supposed to work, and it can get disrupted by having a deuterium atom instead of hydrogen. But I want to review this thing with that H, because the three carbon sugar, the H gets grabbed off, the good H, you know, that's been already cleaned by the isomerase. It just stuck onto NAD plus to make NADH. And then the NADH actually delivers that H through the dehydrogenase. It delivers it to the ATPase pump. So that H came off already before the molecule that came from glucose makes it to the citric acid cycle. It's already gone, but it's gone to a good purpose because it's made an NADH. And then some more NADHs are made in the course of that citric acid cycle. And those are fed in as well. The NADH dehydrogenase is a mitochondrial enzyme. It's in the mitochondrial DNA code. And that enzyme is really important that's all those different steps in the electron transport chain, you know, that all those different stages, each one of them, most of them are pumping NADH H into the intermembrane.
I imagine it like a gear almost, right? Because, like, NADH is, it gets created on one part of the reaction and used somewhere else. And it acts as it allows the entire reaction to go, because if you can't pull that hydrogen off of the sugar as it's in the TCA cycle, the cycle can't continue.
Right, the hydrogens are getting pulled off one by one and stuck onto NADH. And succinate dehydrogenase is different because it actually puts those hydrogens directly into the membrane. And that's the coenzyme Q10, you know, that's very important for energy. That's getting loaded up with those H's that came from succinate. And the succinate has also been through a process to make sure those H's don't have deuterium. All these molecules that make their way into the mitochondria to contribute to those protons that are inside that intermembrane space, they've all been carefully selected and filtered to get rid of the deuterium in the whole process, even going back to what's going on in the cytoplasm. It is truly amazing how much biology devotes to, how much energy it devotes to getting rid of deuterium in the mitochondria.
And so
amazed by that.
How does glyphosate interrupt that process?
Well, that's the excellent question. And that's because the dehydrogenases are messed up by glyphosate. Almost all of them, I think. Really, really interesting, because there's a whole class of enzymes that are dehydrogenases. There's many of them. And for example, there's a paper on E. coli bacteria exposed to glyphosate. And they showed there was like a dozen different dehydrogenases that they showed experimentally were suppressed by glyphosate. And that doesn't surprise me because the dehydrogenases, they bind NAD and they bind also FAD, their flavoproteins. FAD and NAD are cousins. You know, they're both these dinucleotides. And both of them are really, really important in all these energetic reactions. And so I got lost my chain of thought there.
Yes, the way that, so how glyphosate interrupts the deuterium filtering pathway.
Yeah, we're getting there. So glyphosate suppresses all these dehydrogenases, and all these, most of these reactions that are dehydrogenase reactions are loading up NAD with an H. They're producing NADH from NAD+.
Well, yeah, because the hydrogen has to go somewhere. Like if you just start releasing hydrogen into the cell after
dehydrogenase, they're taking a hydrogen off of the atom, off of the molecule.
And you have to put it somewhere, because if you don't, then you start acidifying the cell. And so this is like, if your molecules can't take the hydrogen, but the dehydrogenase is still clipping it off, then it's just acidifying the environment of the cell, right?
That would be, yes, because you'd end up with extra hydrogens in the water. But they make the NAD plus gets converted to NADH. NADH gets fed to the mitochondria, and then it's got this golden age because of this process. These dehydrogenases are called flavoproteins. Flavoproteins know how to select hydrogen over deuterium. So already they're not going to choose it if it's a deuterium. Hmm. And then on top of that, something before has often tried to make sure that hydrogen's not deuterium as well. So the body's really obsessing on making sure hydrogens aren't deuterium if they're going to end up in the mitochondria. And so the dehydrogenases are suppressed by glyphosate as a class. So every one of those dehydrogenases that's trying to produce NADH is weakened by glyphosate. And in fact, there was a study from even the 1980s on glyphosate that showed in the mitochondria, glyphosate suppressed the production of NADH in the mitochondria, which means dehydrogenases, you know?
And is when they did this study in the mitochondria, was it in human mitochondria? Do you know?
I think it was human mitochondria grown in a culture.
So that seems like a pretty stunning and alarming finding. Like, how do people?
And it was from the 1980s.
Does it just like get buried with time there's not enough people?
I mean,
people
usually
get
published in obscure journals and the news media never pick up on it. You know, it's really sad to me that how much the science is suppressed. It really is amazing, you know. But lately we've had a lot of papers coming out, pretty dramatic, and even papers showing, for example, one that looked at girl babies born to mothers and measured the glyphosate level in the urine of the mothers during pregnancy. I think it was during the third trimester. And then they looked at the girl babies. There's a particular metric that's called the anogenital distance. And you can kind of imagine what that might be. And that apparently is a metric that can tell you whether the child was exposed to too much testosterone in the utero. And so they confirmed that there was a statistically significant correlation between the glyphosate level in the urine of the mother, just in a single sample, which is amazing to me that they could get statistical significance out of this. And this distance, which was too long, indicating testosterone, excess testosterone in utero. And that's a bad metric because it predicts polycystic ovary syndrome, much higher risk of PCOS if you have this problem with this developmental problem. And polycystic ovary syndrome is an epidemic today. It's the number one cause of infertility in women. And it's also correlated with both having autism and producing autistic kids. So that's a big deal. And that's because of too much testosterone in utero, which is explainable because glyphosate disrupts aromatase, which is the enzyme that converts testosterone to estrogen.
God, there's so much in there. Before we get to what sounds like an astounding link that might last across generations, right? Because if you have a child in utero exposed to glyphosate, which then develops PCOS, which even if that child isn't consuming glyphosate for their life, it sounds like there's an increased risk downstream of having complications when that child has her own children.
Yeah, even if she was from then on never exposed to glyphosate, she's got this problem that isn't indicated. It's going to probably cause an increased risk of PCOS without any more glyphosate exposure. There have been studies, and these are some very exciting studies that have happened recently as well, where they exposed rats to pregnant rat to low dose glyphosate at a critical developmental period. And they know this. They know that if toxic exposures during that critical period can cause long-term effects on future generations. So they did this experiment, and then they looked at the mouse was fine, the pregnancy went well, the babies were fine, you know, the pups were fine. The pups grew up and had pups, and they went to two or three future generations, and every generation got worse in terms of various problems with reproductive issues and diabetes, I mean, obesity, all these different conditions were showing up in the future generations from the exposure of the great-grandmother. It was amazing.
I want to explore that, but I want to also get back to the question of inflammation, because we started to touch upon it when we got to this like redox stuff that's happening in the mitochondria. And we mentioned earlier that we had talked to Thomas Seyfried, and Thomas Seyfried's like, look, cancer is a metabolic disorder that begins with the mitochondria. And so I wonder if you can help us to close the loop between these metabolic reactions and inflammation, and then the link between inflammation and this massive diversity of diseases.
And that's a big one. That's a really big one. But I have a lot of things to say.
Maybe
about
one or two
it,
sentences.
No,
I'm kidding.
I think inflammation is a sign of a deuterium problem. It's an indicator of a deuterium problem, and it's really, really interesting because inflammation ends up producing hydrogen peroxide, and then the hydrogen peroxide gets converted to two molecules of water. For example, with glutathione can convert the hydrogen peroxide to two molecules of water with this glutathione peroxidase. And then the glutathione becomes oxidized, but it protects from that. Hydrogen peroxide is toxic. And there's also superoxide along the way too. So superoxide, which is really toxic, hydrogen peroxide, which is toxic, and then water. It's a three-step process. And with enzymes that do that for you. And so the hydrogen peroxide is reduced in deuterium. It's producing hydrogen peroxide that's reduced in deuterium. And then it's converting it to two molecules of water that are reduced in deuterium. So that whole process of inflammation is generating deuterium depleted water. That's its goal. That's its reason for being. And whenever you see inflammation, what you are seeing is a situation where the mitochondria are stressed because there's too much deuterium. That's what I believe. So it's central. The deuterium is central to the inflammatory problem.
Is there a easy way that people can offset the balance other than glyphosate? Like, is there a way to, I hate to say clean yourself of this, but is that a good idea? And are there methods for that?
There's an easy way, which is the ketogenic diet.
Hmm.
Ketogenic diet. And that's also really, really interesting. The different foods have different levels of deuterium in them. And the lowest deuterium foods are fats, and particularly animal-based fats. And so if you eat a high fat, saturated fats are really, really good. That's the lowest deuterium. So saturated fats are a healthy diet, which is kind of astonishing to people because they've been told for so long not to eat saturated fats. But I eat a lot of butter, coconut oil, organic lard. These are my fats, and I use them a lot. I'm completely generous with the use of fats in my food.
Yeah, me too. The myth of cholesterol is this demon that we were raised with as kids, and even that's one of the first things they screen for at the doctor's office and so forth.
I know.
What do you have any insight into how that happened?
I do. And I'm actually really, that's where I started actually. When I first started looking at toxic exposures, the first thing I looked at was statin drugs. And I really hate statin drugs. I think they're nothing but trouble. I don't think anybody's benefiting from them. And a lot of people are getting harmed. They basically make you grow older faster. Mm. And there's no way that I would ever take one. So it's so strange with the, of course, they figured out they had this drug that could lower your cholesterol dramatically. And so they wanted to convince you that that was a good idea to do that, right? So they could sell the drug. And at the same time, the glyphosate was showing up. And I think glyphosate's playing a role, a critical role in heart disease as well. And I think it's because of disruption of sulfation pathways. And so cholesterol is a vital molecule, as you know, in the membranes, and it's especially important in the brain. The brain's got way more cholesterol compared to its weight than other parts of the body. It's loaded with cholesterol, and it's very important for neuron transmission and things like that, neural signals. Cholesterol can be distributed throughout the body without having to be packed up inside a lipid particle if it's got a sulfate attached to it. Cholesterol sulfate becomes water soluble, and it can get across the water barrier that's in the blood. So you're making cholesterol sulfate in your skin with sunlight catalyzes the synthesis of cholesterol sulfate in the skin. And the HDL particles, which are the little guys, they go into the skin and they pick up the cholesterol sulfate. It can just be dropped off without any complicated transport mechanism. They pick it up in their membrane and they actually carry it around and deliver it to the LDL particles. So they're like little boats that go to the shore and pick up the goods and take them to the big boat. You know, they're delivering the cholesterol sulfate to the molecules of all of the, to the red blood cells. They have cholesterol sulfate in their membrane, and all the lipid particles like LDL particles and HDL particles, they pick up cholesterol sulfate in their membrane. And the sulfate gels the water around the particle to make it safe, to protect it from glycation damage and from oxidation damage. So the lipid particles that have lots of cholesterol sulfate in the membrane, they're very safe. If there isn't enough cholesterol sulfate, the lipid particles become vulnerable to attack. They become oxidized, and that's when they start to gather in the blood vessels and cause this, you know, plaque and all this kind of stuff that causes heart disease. So it's the lack of cholesterol sulfate that's the cause of heart disease. And the reason why cholesterol sulfate is deficient is because glyphosate messes up the sulfation pathways. It can't connect the sulfate to the cholesterol because glyphosate disrupts that enzyme.
Is that only available in the skin? How much of this is a deficiency in sulfate? Are people have plenty of sulfate, they're just not able to articulate it properly?
Yeah, I think they have a huge problem with sulfate. And the problem is that if you just throw free sulfate into the blood, it'll gel the blood. And you can't do that. You need to have the blood to flow. It can't be too viscous. So that you have this whole mechanism of transporting sulfate by attaching it to the membranes of these lipid, of these molecules that are not water soluble. So it allows them to move through the blood freely. Even vitamin D gets sulfated. And if it's sulfated, it could just go into the blood. If it's not, it has to be packaged up inside a lipid particle. So everything that doesn't get sulfated, that's a vital nutrient, has to be packaged up in the lipid particle. The LDL goes up. And so, I think there's multiple problems in the sulfation. There's multiple enzymes in the sulfation pathway that have what I call a glyphosate susceptibility motif, meaning that they bind phosphate at a site where glycine is highly conserved. And I write about that in my book. But that's the critical thing about glyphosate. Those particular enzymes are very sensitive to glyphosate. And there's a long list of them because things that bind phosphate, they could be binding ATP, they could be binding PLP, there's I've forgotten what that's called, a vitamin B, a B vitamin phosphate. I think it's B3 phosphate. I'm not sure. No, not B3. Sorry.
Is there any alternative for people who are living away from the equator? You know, I think a lot of us don't get enough sunlight. And
right.
It feels like a Sisyphean battle to try to keep up with it, especially in these long winters.
That is a problem. And you know, cholesterol sulfate can be made without sunlight. Sunlight just accelerates the rate at which it's made. So you don't have to have sunlight to make it. It just helps. It just allows you to make more. Mm-hmm. And of course, you make vitamin D as well. And vitamin D is also very, very important. So, you can eat foods that are high in sulfur. And I do that. I'm very big on sulfur-containing foods. And if people are interested, that includes the cruciferous vegetables, onions, garlic, seafood, grass-fed beef, eggs, lots of animal-based foods have healthy sources of sulfur and all these vegetables. So she's smiling.
I'm smiling because I started eating.
You getting hungry over there?
No, I was thinking about this. I started eating a midday snack of like sardines crushed with hard-boiled eggs and hot sauce.
That's really good.
Shiloh was disgusted by me.
Smelly combination.
Yeah, sardines are kind of a lot of people have trouble with sardines, but they are super healthy. They've got so many vitamins and minerals and healthy fats. I mean, they're really perfect. And
that's
sulfur.
What I said. I just happened to smell like a, you know, an alley cat afterwards.
I mean, while we're talking about it, it seems like the best, I mean, none of us are medical doctors, but it seems like this is like the easiest way to avoid all these problems is avoiding, well, the easiest way to avoid glyphosate, I suppose, is to avoid the foods that it's used on. Is right. that primarily grains?
You would be surprised how many foods have Everything. Glyphosate in them. It's really scary. Gotcha. Zen Honeycutt is a friend of mine. She founded the organization Moms Across America, and she's been testing various things. She's really great. She's been testing various kinds of foods. And one thing she did was she has these moms. So she's got all these moms that help her out, and she had them collect food from their kids' school lunches and send it to this lab to get it tested for glyphosate. And 95% of the samples came out positive. This is the school lunch samples. And then she did fast food restaurants. And so she had, I think it was 40 fast food restaurants and the samples of their food. And 100% of them came out contaminated with glyphosate. 100%.
I am deeply suspicious of fast food. Something weird and gross has started happening. There's a place that I love In-N-Out. I grew up in California. It's just, it's wired into my DNA. Some of my
East Coast people probably don't even know what that is.
They probably do at this point because it's such a cult thing. But like when I was a kid, my sister and I would stay up late after everybody had gone to bed. And then like we'd sneak out of the house and In-N-Out was open until 1 o'clock in the morning. And so we'd go get In-N-Out. And so it's just like wired into all of these formative, warm memories. And I've recently like completely cut out anything that's not organic. I've been eating a lot of animal products. And we had In-N-Out recently, and my gums bled for 2 days afterwards.
Oh, my. That's
but I didn't
amazing.
Have the buns, and my gums did not bleed.
And so I'm just like, I'm keenly aware that there's something in the...
Or the french fries.
Or the... Stop telling on
just
me.
Just saying.
Are you on a low-carb diet?
I mean, yeah, I've just completely stopped eating sugar and carbs and everything.
Well, like, we have this...
a wise move.
It's just, I don't know if it's like, I can't moderate all the health effects and everything. Like it's not my primary area of research, but I could tell you it feels great. Like, and it might just be my chemistry and just completely anecdotal, but it feels amazing. Like I used to, after dinner, just want to like lie down basically, like almost my whole life. I felt like if I eat a big meal, I'm just like, oh, like I just want to go to sleep or at least like watch a movie or something. And you don't get any of those effects if you stop eating sugar and carbs. It's really
Isn't
incredible.
That interesting?
You just eat a big meal and you're like, I'm full, but I could work some more. I could do stuff. I could actually go for a walk or do things. And,
yeah, that's interesting. It frustrates me that I think a lot of people think it's not possible that food could be so important in life. And I really think it's absolutely crucial. If somebody goes on a low-fat diet, I mean, good luck. I think they're going to get sick, you know, because fats are so vital to your health. And people have been taught to eat low fat. And I think it's a terrible recommendation. Absolutely terrible.
And, yeah, that and was my parents' generation was taught that. That's what I kind of grew up on under in the 80s.
Yeah, that was
fat.
So
everything
big.
Low fat, margarine.
I never bought into it. I'm really proud of myself. And I always bought butter. I never bought margarine. You know, I was very suspicious of the fake foods early on. And it's just getting worse and worse. We've got so many crazy things coming out these days. That are very disturbing. You know, they're making fake milk in the lab. It's just we're going
it's really, to
a bad place.
You have to get, people don't understand that you have to get over this literal physiological addiction that like you feel, you really, when especially when you stop eating carbs and sugar, you really, really, like it hurts for the first week or two. I actually had almost like a flu-like kind of thing happen. I don't know if that's related or not. But it's very much like going through withdrawal from a drug, like a deep drug, I imagine, where your dopamine's kind of depleted. You really just want it. You have the cravings. But the funny thing is, after you get through that first week or two, it's just gone. Like I don't crave it at all anymore. Like I don't have that same like dopaminergic association with it anymore. And I think a lot of people just like if you probably trying to convince people that smoking was bad for them back in the 1960s was the same problem because everybody's addicted and doesn't want to hear about it.
Right.
It's like, well,
good analogy.
Just try it.
Yeah, it's funny how people actually get addicted to sugar, but I really think they do.
100%.
Your metabolism has adjusted somehow to expect that sugar as part of the whole program. And so taking it away is almost like withdrawal. Thank you.
And once the funny thing is with those things is like once you're through that stage, then you don't miss it anymore. But It's hard to get, I think that's for most people, it's like, it's hard to even go a day without carbs or sugar because it's that first, that's the worst part of it, right? That initial period is the hardest part. And then.
Yeah, I've never experienced that because I was always, I've always been low carb. I've always believed in fats. So I've never experienced that kind of withdrawal problem. And I don't much like sugar. I mean, I can eat it, but I don't crave it, you know?
No doubt that's contributed to you sitting here doing research after all these decades.
Still have a brain that can think. You know, a lot of people my age don't. So
that's my like highest long-term goal, I think. I'm like, as soon as I can't think anymore, just let me go.
I know. I feel that way too. The brain is so important.
What are you going to say, Nastya?
I was going to see, do we feel like we've covered the way that inflammation is the root of all of these different disorders and the direct link to glyphosate sufficiently? Like, I think that I have a decent model for it, which is that you said something really important, which is that you've identified a motif that you think is indicative of proteins that are susceptible to damaged by glyphosate. And the motif is that they have a conserved glycine in a phosphate binding pocket, which is that, and for anybody who's not a protein biochemist, which I assume is, I don't know, maybe a couple of people out there.
People are just turning off this podcast right now. You can dumb it down for us.
Stephanie, do you want to lay out what exactly that means for people?
Yeah, well, so there are many really important biological molecules that contain phosphate, as you know. For example, DNA, right? DNA has these phosphate connectors, and then you have these nucleotides. You know, because you have like NAD, right? NAD is nicotinamide adenine dinucleotide. And that's got two phosphates hooking the two guys together. The two nucleotides are hooked together by two phosphates. So all these, and pyridoxal phosphate is the one I was trying to think of, which is a B vitamin. And I'm forgetting which B vitamin it is, but that's the one that I was talking about, that enzyme that converts methionine to cysteine. And that guy binds, it depends upon that B vitamin to work. And it binds to that B vitamin at a site where it's got four highly conserved glycines. And so, and in fact, mutations at that site cause severe disease. Now, really debilitating disease from birth, you know, it's a genetic mutation that's absolutely devastating. And it looks like autism, but it's worse, really, and developmental delay and all of those things. So if that enzyme is completely broken, but glyphosate only nibbles on it, you know, it doesn't break it completely. And so it just disrupts the ability to make enough cysteine. And of course, cysteine makes glutathione, and glutathione protects from oxidative damage, which is what this inflammation is all about, right? The inflammation induces oxidative damage, and you don't have enough glutathione to mop it up. And then your mitochondria get damaged. And once they're damaged, they actually continue. Too much deuterium in the mitochondria causes two problems. It can't make as much ATP. It's inefficient at making ATP. And it's spewing out reactive oxygen at higher rates. So it's breaking the mitochondria.
Is that mitochondrially inflicted damage, is it intentional? Like, does that serve a defensive purpose normally under healthy inflammation?
Well, the reason why inflammation is healthy is because it's making deuterium-depleted water. That's why it's healthy, I think. The goal of the inflammatory response is to make deuterium-depleted water, which is desperate to fix the mitochondria.
I mean, inflammation is an enormous concept, right? There's so many things under the blanket of that, like involving the ability of immune cells to squeeze between tight junctions and get around the body and, you know, elevating temperature for wound healing and mobilization of different subcompartment cell types and all of this stuff, right? There's so much going on.
Yeah, there's a whole bunch of signaling that goes on with the inflammatory response beyond making this reactive oxygen, but...
And I guess my question is, what is the, and I should probably know this, but what is the feature that's activating the damage of the mitochondria? Is it just the deuterium, in your opinion? Is that just is that what's happening?
Well, I mean, there's a lot of poisons that can mess up the mitochondria. So it's not just the deuterium, but the deuterium effect of glyphosate is really, really strong.
With respect to the inflammation itself, I guess. what is the mechanism by which the inflammation is damaging the mitochondria? I'm sorry, you probably...
It sounds like it was the superoxide generation, because the final step in the electron transport chain is the production of the split oxygen. And that oxygen needs to be immediately sopped up by hydrogens in order to not just ravage the...
Right, exactly. That's how you make the water, right? You combine the oxygen, you split the oxygen, you make water from the hydrogens that are coming across the membrane. They're being pumped out through the ATPase pumps. This massive hydrogen movement, protons are being pushed out, and they grab that, those oxygen, you split the oxygen. O dot is very, very toxic. You know, so the oxygen and then it becomes hydrogen peroxide, which is also reactive, and then water. And the water is what you need. The water is fine, but you've got to put four hydrogens in there to get the water. Two of them will only get you hydrogen peroxide out of oxygen, right?
Are we talking about immune inflammation?
I mean, that's the only kind I know.
Right. Okay. So I'm stuck on an earlier step, which is that you're saying that the process is to create deuterium depleted water, because that's important. And I'm like, water doesn't figure directly into the mitochondrial and metabolic reactions.
It does kind of, because it's producing what they call metabolic water. And Laszlo Boros talks about that. He suspects that the water inside the mitochondria is extremely depleted in deuterium. I don't think anyone's been able to measure it. It's too hard to get at that water. But he's guessing that Laszlo's an expert on deuterium, that it's extremely depleted. And it's interesting with the whole way that these reactions happen. For example, in the peroxisome, right? If you've heard of the peroxisome, and that's where it's metabolizing fats, right? Peroxisome or proteins. I'm getting a little bit weak. I think it's proteins. I'm not sure.
I
all I know is it breaks down stuff inside the cell.
I like vaguely remember, I think that it must be proteins because it's involved in the MHC complex, where it like displays the digested proteins. And if I remember, I've recently taught like medical microbiology, and so like I roughly had to touch on this, and I'm pretty sure that it has to do.
It's like fatty acid oxidation as well.
Fatty acids, yeah. Okay. So maybe both. I was saying fats and proteins, but maybe both. But anyway, it does produce peroxisome. It produces peroxide, right? And then that gets converted to hydrogen peroxide by this catalase. I'm not going to remember. What's the other one? Superoxide dismutase. Superoxide dismutase converts superoxide into hydrogen peroxide, and then catalase converts hydrogen peroxide into two molecules of water. And that double sequence, that sequence is really important for making deuterium depleted water. And the hydrogen peroxide is low in deuterium because of superoxide dismutase, which has a very strong deuterium kinetic isotope effect, meaning that it doesn't like to pull deuterium. It only takes hydrogen. So there's all these enzymes that are able to select for hydrogen and ignore it if it's deuterium at that spot. It won't take it. So it selects those particular versions of that molecule that have hydrogen where it wants it. And then it produces this superoxide. Dismutase produces hydrogen peroxide, and then the catalase produces two molecules of water. And that system is really important, and that water is getting delivered to the mitochondria.
And so inflammation... if you think about the way that immune cells show up, I think that it's one of them. I don't remember which one, but it deposits.
<We're both> struggling.
I know. I mean, like I should know.
What's
this.
The big picture here? Just give me 30,000.
The way that they kill stuff is by dropping hydrogen peroxide.
Oh yeah, that's right.
And
to kill these
reactive oxygen
bombers.
Species. And so I think that it's the neutrophils. They're the ones that have the granules.
Granulocytes. Yeah.
Granulocytes. Thank you. He's the immune guy.
Neutrophils are granulocytes.
Okay. All right.
It's getting so nerdy in here. Oh my goodness.
Yeah, the nomenclature is really tough with the immune system, isn't it? I get confused all the time.
Right.
But it's such an incredible interface too. It seems like where all of the progress is going to be, because they're like these very bizarre cells that are almost neuronal-like, and they're autonomous and they walk around. They're just It's my favorite system.
Right. But before we get into the like the nerdy depths of the immune system and inflammation, I think that there's inflammation that can be chemically caused, which then generates a larger immune yes. cascade. Because if you have these superoxides, if you have these hydrogen peroxides, what they're going to be doing is they're going to be ripping molecules apart. They're going to be ripping yes. cells apart. And as the cells get damaged, they're going to start leaking their contents. And as they start to leak their contents, the intracellular, the stuff that's supposed to be inside the cell being yes. outside the cell, is literally the activating signal for the immune right. system to come in and start dealing with inflammation.
And feedback, et cetera.
And feedback. And so, if I can tell, like, check to see if this is the right arc. If you have deuterium-heavy molecules that are getting into the mitochondria, what's happening is that at the electron transport chain, which needs to have these clean hydrogens in order to split water safely, mm-hmm. you're splitting the water and it no longer can, or you're splitting oxygen. Sorry, you have to split oxygen safely in order to be transformed into water. But if you have a mm-hmm. depletion of hydrogens that are being stuck in places as deuteriums instead of moving smoothly as hydrogens, you're still splitting the oxygen, but you're producing something that's causing damage to your membranes and proteins, which then starts to break these barriers apart, and that creates dysfunctional mitochondria. As the mitochondria break, then all of these superoxides get into the rest of the cell. They're causing damage to the rest of the cell. At some point, the cell itself starts to break down, and the proteins that are being shown on the surface of the membrane by these immune complexes are now being determined by the body as indicating damage. And so the body has to come and destroy the cell that has the dysfunctional mitochondria. Yeah. And that is now at the point where if all of your cells are showing broken proteins, that means that it's going to, at the very least, some kind of low-grade autoimmune reaction at all times, because every single cell in your body is now like, hey, I'm filled with broken pieces.
That sounds great. That sounds very good to me. Thank you.
That's crazy. How do you think this ties into autoimmune diseases? Because like autism is not autoimmune, but this seems like it's such
autism
a global...
Autism probably is autoimmune. A lot of people have written about autism being an autoimmune disease.
Interesting. And yeah. Do you have a good sense of the mechanism by which those two are related?
Yeah. Well, glyphosate, one thing is glyphosate messes proteins up and then they don't fold correctly. And then so parts of the protein can become exposed that normally wouldn't be. And then the immune cells see that as a foreign protein because they were trained on the protein in the proper shape. But then when the protein changes its shape because of these glyphosate bullets that are in it, it can become exposed to the immune cells and they'll recognize it as a foreign protein. They won't think of it as self. And then you'll get autoimmune reaction to it.
Oh, that's fascinating. Yeah, 2020 paper, autoimmunity in autism.
There you go.
I mean, this is kind of horrifying, right? Because it's in the food supply. It's legal
yeah,
in the
it's
country.
It's really horrifying.
There's a lot of lobbying. And it's obvious that people are getting progressively unhealthier.
At younger ages.
At younger yeah. ages. Like the rate at which autism is being diagnosed is climbing. And some people are like, it's because there's
also,
more diagnosis.
Also, the scary thing for me is it seems cumulative. Like you might have done this, you might change your diet and all these things. I imagine it takes a long time to heal from all of the damage
right.
that you've undergone in throughout your younger
and
years.
It's hard to get the glyphosate out because it's embedded in all your proteins. You've probably got lots of it in your collagen because collagen has long sequences of GXY, GXY, GXY. Every third amino acid is a glycine. Collagen is getting messed up by glyphosate. And that's what I think is causing all these different issues that we have with knee replacement surgery and hip replacement surgery, back pain, you know, all these issues we have with our bones and our joints. They're not behaving properly. And I think that glyphosate's a major player in that.
Do you think that there's like healing possible by adding better collagen sources into your diet going forward? Like you do, there is some protein turnover, right? The cells only live so long before they get replaced.
Right. Yeah, collagen is kind of a long-lived molecule, but not necessarily. Like the cancer cells are constantly recycling their collagen. It's quite interesting. And they're grabbing the proline out of the collagen and using it as a substitute for succinate to fuel the mitochondria. That's really interesting. People are getting interested in proline and its relationship to cancer. And I think there's pay dirt there. People should be looking into that more. It's because the succinate dehydrogenase is broken, you find another way to supply those protons to the mitochondria. It does the same thing that succinate dehydrogenase does. The proline dehydrogenase can put protons into the mitochondrial membrane like succinate dehydrogenase does.
But you think that it's not as functional, or like, why does that replacement cause problems?
Well, you have to chew up your matrix to do that. So they're constantly breaking down their extracellular matrix to extract the proline. And then proline actually traps deuterium. So proline's not such a good choice for if you're looking for deuterium depletion. But the enzyme is able to select for hydrogen. So what's left behind is proline that's even richer in deuterium because it takes out the proline molecules that have hydrogen. So the cancer cell actually goes through a cycle of chewing up its membrane, using the prolines to supply energy to the mitochondria, leaving behind proteins that are richer in deuterium and putting them back into the membrane. So it's enriching the deuterium in its membrane at the same time as it's utilizing proline to get to replace succinate. It's really fascinating.
Is there
glutamate
a way to-
comes in there too as well, because glutamate can get converted to proline. The cancer cells take up a lot of glutamine and they convert it to glutamate. They get the nitrogen, which is good for making the DNA. And then the glutamate can be turned into proline, and the proline goes into the mitochondria. Really interesting.
It is really interesting.
Yeah, that's interesting. That plays in with Thomas Seyfried's idea too, because I think one of the things he does in addition to the keto diet is this amino acid blocker.
But he blocks glutamine as far as I understand it.
Yeah, blocking glutamine because that's what the cancer cells take up.
It's the precursor.
They take up a lot of glutamine. They like glutamine and glucose.
Interesting.
They use both of those, but the glutamine is being used by converting it into proline and feeding it in instead of succinate. So that's another path to get to help the mitochondria make DNA, make ATP.
That's really fascinating. Hey, we're at an hour and a half. Let's take 5 or 10 minutes and like stretch a little bit. I want to digest some of these things, and then like let's see how we can wrap this massive, massive subject into something that can land.
Great.
We are closing in on Demysticon 2024, our very first scientific conference. If you want to come meet up with us in Austin, Texas on April 7th and 8th to catch the eclipse and 2 days of talks and workshops, you should buy tickets now. If you cannot make it to Austin, that's totally fine. We have live stream tickets available. We would love to see you in any capacity that you can make it. See you soon.
Hello. Welcome back.
Welcome back.
Thanks.
How are you feeling?
Good. I really enjoyed this conversation. You guys are smart, which I really like. Well informed.
I mean, this metabolism, this is where basically the area that I did my PhD in. And Shiloh was joking because we often have physics conversations on the podcast, and his PhD was much more on the physics side of things. And so I'm always kind of like on the sidelines while he's nerding out about physics. So I'm like, my hour has come.
That's great.
I mean, I wanted to ask you like a very basic question. Why haven't, well, maybe somebody has and you can point me at this, but is it not so simple as just doing a labeled experiment where you see how the glyphosate is incorporated into these novel proteins as they're synthesized? Has that work been done, or is that just too
difficult?
Yes,
in fact. Oh, it's very interesting. There was a paper published by some researchers who tried to trace glyphosate and see if it was showing up in the proteins. And they had some kind of method to measure the weight to see the protein's weight would be associated with extra stuff stuck on the glycine. And they actually found several proteins that matched, that looked like they had a glyphosate in them. But they said they found them in both the treated group and the untreated group. These were cancer cells that had been grown in culture for many, many years and had probably been fed glyphosate all those years, because glyphosate is typically in these nutrients that they feed these cultures. So I'm guessing that those cultures had glyphosate all over the place in their proteins, starting the experiment. And then they exposed the treatment group to glyphosate. And it's possible that in the way they exposed it, it wasn't able to get in, because it's tricky to get the exposure environment correct to get the glyphosate to be taken up by the cell. So it's possible they blew that. And so the glyphosate didn't get taken up by the cell, but both groups had glyphosate exposure from many, many years in the past. So the marker showed up on both sides. Mm. And they said, since it was essentially the same levels in the treated group versus the untreated group, they dismissed it. But I think they found it.
I see, I see. And sort of lost in the background noise.
But it leads us to what we kind of wanted to land on, which is, why hasn't this been shown yet? Like, because I pulled up a study while we were on break, which was kind of like, it was looking at mammalian cancer cells and it exposed them to glyphosate and was like, we didn't find substitution, but it was a really low powered study. They were like, we did 3 biological replicates. And that they basically published the conclusion as being like, well, obviously it doesn't get incorporated. And I'm like, that seems like not really.
Yeah, like, what is the $1 million experiment that would?
Well,
that would...
there was an experiment that was done by Monsanto researchers. I'm buzzing. Do you hear the buzz in my ear?
No. Or is it our fault? It might be our fault.
No, I think it's probably me. It's okay now, I think. Okay. Monsanto researchers did a study in the 1980s that I thought was excellent. They exposed bluegill sunfish to radio-labeled glyphosate. And they were looking for whether glyphosate accumulates in the tissues. So they took tissue samples from these bluegill sunfish, and they found radiation in the tissue samples. So then they said, well, let's test for glyphosate the normal way, the regular way. And they came up short. Only 20% of the radiation could be accounted for as glyphosate. So then they said, well, why don't we add some, you know, enzymes and some hydrochloric acid, break down the proteins into individual amino acids and try again. And they did that, and the yield went up to 80%. And they said perhaps glyphosate was incorporated into the proteins. That's their words.
Wow. And this is it was not published. Why would Monsanto even put that out?
They didn't put it out. It's unpublished. Nice. Anthony Samsel got it through a FOIA request. And he signed a document that said he would not show it to anybody.
Government.
Yeah. So it's a secret document. And we wrote about it in a paper. So we have a published paper where we talk about that. And we have the reference there. The unpublished report.
It's such an interesting aspect because, you know, when we're learning science, we learn about how it's strange that you don't get to publish negative data, and everybody thinks, oh, well, there's probably some interesting stuff there, but you never think about the incentive not to publish negative data like this also. Well, this isn't negative data, but it's certainly negative.
Well, it's damning data, and there's no way that Monsanto would want it to be published. I think Monsanto folks, I'm guessing that they know this is happening. And they want to keep it under wraps. So they're claiming that it's not possible, but it is possible because there's many different, and I talk about all this in my book. I have a whole chapter in my book that's devoted to all these arguments that support this theory. And there's several other known severely toxic molecules that work by substituting for amino acids during protein synthesis. So that process is known to happen with other toxic exposures. And just not with glycine. I don't know any other amino acid that, any other toxin that substitutes for glycine except glyphosate.
I would think, though, that among scientists who I've generally found them to be health conscious, socially conscious, results conscious people, everybody's looking for the big blockbuster finding that would show once and for all that there's this thing in the environment that's harmful, that's doing bad things. Why isn't there a lot more robust data about this? Is this a hard thing to study? Are there forces that are tamping it down? Like, what's your take
on this?
I just
think that the chemical industry, the agrochemical industry and the pharmaceutical industry, they have control over what's going on in the research space. They control all the journals. You know, it's very, very difficult to get something published if it's claiming one of these golden money makers is toxic. They do everything they can to keep that from getting published. And then if it gets published, they try to get it retracted. I mean, this is their game. And so the lawyers can't defend someone because they'll say, well, there's no research literature that proves that. So they throw away all the studies that are independent in many cases when they find ways to say those studies are weak or whatever, and they throw them away. So it's an amazing process by which the industry controls the messaging on these chemicals. And we're exposed to so many chemicals today. It's just ridiculous compared to when I was a child. I mean, it's just unbelievable how many different chemicals we're exposed to. We have no clue about how they interact with each other. We can guess that there's going to be severe interaction because glyphosate disrupts enzymes that metabolize other toxic chemicals. So that's a double whammy. You know, the two of them are going to work together to make the toxicity much worse than it would be. Even just the combination of those two becomes much worse than each one individually. You know what I mean? The combination accentuates the toxicity of each one.
I mean, I think that it's easy to say that it's better than it was in, say, the 1950s, because the Cuyahoga River hasn't caught fire in like 30
That's
years.
That's a good point. Well, Kennedy has done a good job of cleaning up the Connecticut, you know, riverways. He's my hero, Robert Kennedy.
Yeah, I mean, he's done incredible work, and he's been fighting on the right side of these things for a long time. And so there's these two things that both must be true, that it's that the really obvious things that you can point to that don't require deep epidemiological studies, those have been largely cleaned up. There's not like decaying drums full of highly toxic waste on the sides of rivers anymore. And so in that sense, it has gotten better. But I think that you're absolutely right that now we're just awash with these chemicals that no one really knows what their provenance is, and the studies that seem to look at them in very constrained conditions rather than massive chronic exposure, rather than in mixtures of exposures, because
it gets complicated so quickly. And for example, I was talking about farmers, the people who sued Monsanto for glyphosate exposure and non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, none of them are farmers, and yet farmers get lots of exposure to glyphosate. And I asked a lawyer why that's true, and he said because you can't prove it with the farmers. They have so many other exposures, you can always point to the other thing and say that's what caused their problem, you know.
You know,
so it becomes very hard to focus on one chemical that they were exposed to.
Do you know Tyrone Hayes's work?
I do, yes. I've seen him in lecture twice. He's wonderful. His atrazine is the thing he's focused on, and he is the atrazine as I am to glyphosate, is how I feel.
Yeah, absolutely. And he's been showing for decades now that at low quantities of atrazine that are in environmental conditions for frogs causes them to develop all of these weird reproductive
issues.
What's
atrazine?
Atrazine's a pesticide, right?
Yeah, it's very much like glyphosate. It's an herbicide. All the herbicides are toxic, in my opinion. I think we need to ban all of them, all of the chemical-based herbicides. And we need to find a better way to do agriculture. And we can do that. Actually, you can use robotics. I have friends who are building robotic tractors that are run on solar energy and have, you know, vision guidance, and they can recognize weeds and they can shoot them with boiling water. I mean, there are ways that you could kill the weeds that don't involve a lot of massive human labor. And that's what we need to focus on.
I saw one with lasers, which I thought was both
right,
cool
lasers.
And terrifying.
I know. You might not want to get the laser hitting into your eye by mistake.
It's really interesting. Like, there's something really insidious, too, about Bayer acquiring Monsanto, too, where mm-hmm. it's almost like you own both the problem and the solution, right?
Exactly.
So you have investments on both sides of the fence, which I think makes it probably an even more momentous monster to try to get in the way of.
I think the pharmaceutical industry wants us to be sick. I really do. I think they love
it. Certainly profitable.
That's the thing. Why would they want to cure us so they can't sell the drugs anymore? Suppose we don't have diabetes, we don't have high blood pressure. They lose a lot of money.
And another interesting thing is it looks like Bayer, right after they acquired Monsanto, there was some serious lawsuits. I think it was like this groundskeeper who got some lymphoma. And they lost this lawsuit.
Dwayne Lee Johnson. Yeah, that was the first big one. In fact, the Monsanto executives told them, we've had some lawsuits, but we've never lost. So don't worry about the lawsuits, you know. And so Bayer naively believed them. But I think Monsanto had a very good team of lawyers to defend their product. And as soon as Bayer took over, I think they lost the ability to fight as well as Monsanto had fought. I'm guessing. Mm. But also we had a better case at that point too, because I actually helped Bobby Kennedy was involved in that lawsuit. And I actually fed them materials that I had gathered about glyphosate that helped them to make that case.
But that's so bizarre that you would go from winning this, what was it? Like billions of, excuse me. Yeah. What was the original settlement? I know it's
the original settlement was millions. $289 million and then was reduced down to $21 million, but they were ordered to pay $2.5 billion in damages to a different couple in California,
right.
And that was cut down to $87 million.
It's a jury trial, and the jury awards a huge amount, and then the judge cuts it back, and then Monsanto basically says tries to appeal.
But what's so odd is that how could you lose a case like this and then have the different state agencies say that there's no harm posed by glyphosate.
I know. That's what's so crazy.
That's
really
the craziest
crazy.
Part.
Yeah.
How is that
but
possible?
There's thousands of lawsuits, maybe hundreds of thousands of lawsuits in the wings. There were five altogether. So there were those three in rapid succession. There were two more recently, I think Pennsylvania and Missouri, major wins on non-Hodgkin's lymphoma.
Like, what would it take? Would one of those victims have to sue the state, essentially, to have to somehow incriminate the state in as complicit in this?
Well, yeah, I don't know. I mean, California actually labeled glyphosate as a probable carcinogen. And that was a big deal. That happened, I think, even before.
Well, in California, everything's labeled as a probable carcinogen,
yeah,
so it gets lost in the wash.
Oh, is that right? I didn't know
it's
that.
Just like a
I
label
was really
on literally everything, like every apartment building.
Yeah. But that mattered because they were quite upset. I mean, Monsanto was quite upset about that because our government, federal government, says it's a beautiful chemical. It kills all plants. It doesn't harm humans at all. And they're sticking with that model. Despite
it seems like it would be a good case, a good option for a class action lawsuit, though, against the state, actually.
Yeah.
That seems like some, you know, very ambitious lawyer could stand to make a killing shepherding somebody through who wanted to be the primary litigant on such a case.
I hope somebody comes along who will do that. My goal, personally, is to prove that glyphosate causes autism beyond a shadow of a doubt. I am gathering so much information that fits so beautifully. It's hard. The writing is hard and nobody understands the complexities of the metabolism, you know, so it's very difficult. But I feel there's enough evidence to prove it, in my opinion, and that glyphosate is the primary cause of the autism epidemic. But my idea of proving it and somebody else's are different. You know?
Have,
and that's
have
just
you felt,
based on reading the research literature and connecting the dots.
Mm-hmm.
Have you felt any pressure from your institution to stay away from these things, or has it been a fairly safe space for you? The
they've been wonderful to me so far. I'm always kind of worried that the other shoe's going to drop, but they've been wonderful. I'm actually very impressed that MIT has allowed me to speak out about these issues and hasn't tried to stop me.
Do you think that that's unique to MIT or what is it? Because, you know, I can think of more horror stories than not of people being kind of pushed away from different subjects that might have...
Right.
industrial conflicts of interest and so forth. But
yeah,
seems like a very unique situation to me.
It's amazing, actually. Monsanto has never funded MIT's research. So that's, you know, phew, thank goodness for that. But Bayer certainly has. And so Bayer could come after them. I worry that somebody from Bayer, for example, will remind the MIT folks that I'm doing this and draw their attention to it and then think, oh, we got to stop her. But they haven't. So they haven't. I'm really pleased about that.
We'll keep our fingers
and
crossed.
MIT is pretty open. I think they're pretty better than a lot of other academic institutions in terms of allowing things that are controversial, I would say.
And so what lies ahead for you? You've been collecting evidence. I mean, you already wrote this book. Are you working on another book? Are you working on more scientific papers? What's the path?
Yeah, I've been working mostly on scientific papers. Lately, I'm trying hard to squeeze out as many publications as I can before I retire. I do want to write a book on deuterium, and I've sort of started it. I have plenty of material. I could write a book on deuterium if I can just set aside the time to do that, and I would love to do that. So if I do write another book, I think it'll be on deuterium.
Can you recommend somebody for us to talk to who could just update us on how deuterium interacts with different parts of the body? Because that still is a bit fuzzy for me, and I'd love to learn more about it.
Yeah, you could interview me again because I have a lot more to say.
Okay, let's do it. Let's do it.
Yeah,
for sure.
Laszlo Boros might be a possibility. Laszlo Boros. Do you know him?
Boros, okay.
One who introduced me to deuterium, and I really like him. We've been collaborating. We actually published a paper very recently in Medical Hypotheses on a ketogenic diet as a training program for having the energy to climb Mount Everest. So it's a kind of a cool paper.
Awesome.
On that. So he's into metabolism and foods, you know, eating the right diet. And he knows metabolism very well. He's very good on the metabolic pathways. He's a bright guy.
See if we can catch up with him. And then maybe we'll circle back and you'll have your book ready by then.
Yeah, I know. I do want to come back to those 2-3 carbon sugars that we talked about earlier, because we didn't finish the punchline on that story. So let me
just
tell you the rest of it. You remember the 2-carb sugars and the isomerases and then this guy going off with this dehydrogenase to taking it into the citric acid cycle. that dehydrogenase has a very strong glyphosate susceptibility motif, and I think it's getting suppressed by glyphosate. And if that's true, then those triose phosphates build up. They don't get removed. And if those and when that enzyme is defective, then those triose phosphates get glycated and they produce methylglyoxal. Methylglyoxal is probably the most damaging glycating agent known to mankind, methylglyoxide. So methylglyoxal goes up dramatically when that enzyme is defective. And there's another
What does methylglyoxate do to the body?
It's like glucose on steroids. It's a glycating agent, much worse than glucose. And so methylglyoxal builds up in the muscles and they get damaged by the glycation. They get glycation damage.
And glycation damage is just modification of proteins that makes them dysfunctional, or what is it?
Yeah, they become glycated. And that's glucose being attached to them, or glucose, sugar molecules, various sugar molecules.
So they basically develop these kind of like long trails of sugar molecules that are like chained together on the surface, or it's individual ones?
I don't think so. There is that, though. That's the glycosaminoglycans are these really fascinating molecules that are very complicated and long that are built by the body in the extracellular matrix that makes the gelled water. That's a whole other story, but that's intentional. But the glycation damage, it disturbs these molecules. They have to be broken down, basically, and rebuilt because they're damaged by the sugars. And that's a major part of the toxicity that is associated with diabetes. Diabetes, you end up with all these glycated products that end up with things like your eyes can get in trouble and you can have to chop off your leg and all those kinds of things. You know, you get nasty side effects, eventually consequences of diabetes if you let it go.
Yeah, we didn't even get into the water stuff because that's another one of our favorite topics. So we'll definitely.
Yeah, I would love to. I think we have to do this again. I can't believe that we talked for so long and we didn't run out of ideas, but we have a lot more to talk about. You guys are fantastic because I've never done an interview with anyone that's as bright or as well educated as you guys are. So I really appreciate that.
Hopefully, we're also interesting.
So the crossroads of our interests.
Yeah, definitely.
But yeah, I'm actually getting ready to. I'm going to APS, the American Physical Society, to present some work on structures in water, anomalous structures in biomaterials.
Oh, I would love to know about that.
I'm just like my mind is all thinking about this water stuff lately, and getting ready for next weekend, and so. I definitely want to check out that section of your book, but maybe the next time we meet up, we can start there too, because I know that's a huge part of the discussion. You know, 99 out of 100 molecules in your body being water. It's interesting how it's just the sort of dark matter of biology. And I think there's a lot to unpack there.
Oh, yeah. And you know, glycocalyx, yeah, you know about Pollock's work, right? Gerald Pollock?
He's been on the show a couple times, yeah.
Oh, great. Yeah, he's a good friend of mine, too. He's really awesome. And he taught me all about the glycocalyx and the structured water and all of that stuff, exclusion zone water. Mm-hmm. But that's really interesting because he's shown that the gelled water pushes protons out and develops. It's like a battery. It is a battery. And the protons gather on the surface at the boundary between the gelled water and the fluid water, which is the flowing blood. And so the protons are gathering out there, but the protons that are pushed out are likely not to be deuterons, because the deuterons tend to stick better to the molecules, to the water molecules in the structure. Mm. So you end up with the glycocalyx produces deuterium depleted protons that can then supply electricity to the body very nicely because they're deuterium depleted.
Mm.
So that's really, really interesting.
Yeah, I mean, we're leaving for about 2 months. We're going to be on the road. We're hosting our first conference. It's in Austin in April.
Very nice.
We also have a music project that we're taking on the road. And so we're just kind of...
We'll be back at it this summer. So
yeah,
that's
so we can,
fine. I can wait. Maybe I'll have a book by then.
That'd be cool.
But basically, we can send you a link and we can get something on the calendar for a couple months from now, because it's obviously... at the intersection of a lot of our interests. And
it
so
is.
We'd
I'm
love
so
to
thrilled you. That you guys reached out to me. I really appreciate doing this, and thank you for that opportunity.
And we're so grateful that you came. Thank you.
Yeah, we really appreciate how deeply you've thought about all these subjects. It's rare to find somebody who's gone into every single nook and cranny of some idea and doesn't just stop at the surface level production of things. So I really appreciate that and salute
you.
Your efforts.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. We'll see you next time.
Okay, bye.
Have a great rest of the day.
Thank you.